Wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
This is the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
Down in the new basement studios by the lake, this is what I always refer to. You never call it this, but I always call it our spring special when the seasons change. And we always do a big two-parter where we play loads of clips.
Have the seasons changed? Didn't it just snow this week?
It did snow, but I'm looking outside today. It's a beautiful...
It does seem like spring now.
The lake looks so appealing. Mm-hmm. So much so that maybe I'd rather be out there than in here.
It might be nice. It's a little breezy still.
Yeah, but anyway, cool. For our spring special this year, we had a long discussion about what to do. We hadn't done any sort of music criticism in a while. We hadn't played a lot of music clips. We've done a lot of films and a lot of TV of late.
Yeah.
But we had the idea to talk about, you know, sort of favorite albums. But that is far too...
First albums was what we...
Well, no, I think it originally started with favorite albums, and we sort of agreed that that was far too general and we didn't really get anywhere. So we came up with the idea of first albums. And so the point being that you had to select an album, but it had to have a hook to it as to it was the first of something.
Yeah.
And as we've both discovered, I put a lot of effort into my first bit, and you're just sort of working it out as you go along. Is that correct?
No. What it was when we first talked about first albums, I thought immediately I went to the mind of the first albums from given bands or something that would be like the first album that Bob Dylan did electric or something like that.
Because you're a very literal person, obviously.
I think so.
Yes.
Yeah. But then when I started thinking about what I wanted to talk about, and we talked about this beforehand, was it could be whatever first you want to, and all of mine really ended up being first albums from some element of my own personal music listening history.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, and I think like
the obvious one would be first album I owned, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then there's only one first album you owned, and it would be a very short podcast. Well, that's all we did.
You used an interesting word in there, which I think in researching this, and you use the word personal, I think we have both discovered in researching our own, sort of creating our own lists, that this actually is quite a personal show. And because these are favorites.
In fact, I have some concern. It could be the most personally disliked. You know, we try to avoid being too much about, like, putting in your history, because you never know when
people don't care.
Google's, no. Well, that's that. But you also never know when Google's going to devise something that's going to now transcribe all this and put all the things that we say on a podcast into our profiles when it connects our names with our email addresses and every other bit of information it has about us. So, you know, and then in the future state of the United States government, that could be a thing too.
Yeah.
So I'm always a little concerned about too much disclosure. It feels like this could be the most personal, not personal, like,
no, I don't
literally mean, what happens it, to it, you, but like personal in terms of sentiments, I
yes,
guess.
And I want to say something. If you are listening back in the UK, then the whole notion of this is going to be vaguely familiar. If you're listening in the States, you might not have heard of this. Just recently, a famous radio show from the BBC called Desert Island Discs celebrated its 75th year anniversary.
75 years?
Yeah, I know. Isn't that amazing? I was shocked when I read it in the newspaper that the show has been on for 75th years.
1940
something like, yeah.
Well, it can't have been called Desert Island Discs then.
It was. It's one of the, I think it is, other than like the news.
What were the discs at
that
time?
I have no idea. Benny Goodman? I don't know. Yeah. But what I mean was, anyway, Desert Island Discs is they have a celebrity on, or a person of interest. Actually, celebrity, person of interest makes it sound like it could be a criminal. Although I'm sure there have been some criminals on Desert Island
Probably
Discs.
Had some musicians who ended up being criminals. Yeah. You know?
Desert Island Discs, the person comes on, talks about their life, and the whole gimmick of the show is you get to pick six songs and a article of personal importance that you would take with you if you were marooned on a desert island. So I think this show sort of pays homage to that idea, in that you and I have both picked six albums that represent different firsts. So maybe this is our own tribute to a show that's been on even longer than the Atlantic Voice podcast.
Even longer. If it's hard to believe, you know.
So let's get on with it. We're going to play a lot of clips. We're going to talk a lot of music and shout out all kinds of different things. Master of ceremonies, as you are, because you've organized everything.
Sort of.
Okay, cue us up. Let's get going.
So first album, like I said, is literally the first album I owned, which was Bay City Rollers, Bay City Rollers. So
band
called Bay City Rollers.
Wow.
Album called Bay City Rollers, which was released in 1975. So I would have been 6 years old, assuming I got it right when it came out, which I do not recall exactly when that was. Now, Bay City Rollers, that album, well, first of all, this is a Scottish band, so you should know all about them.
They were huge in England when I was a kid. Yeah. And basically, I was at the age where you just made fun of them for having ridiculous haircuts.
They do have ridiculous.
Which was the trend. We're going to talk about the hair then. Yeah.
But so they, did a number of albums in the, like, 72, 73. I think they came together as a band in the late 60s, although they had some different names and iterations and things like that. But they really hit their stride in the 73, 4, 5 range. And then it was when they went to the United States, this Bass City Rillos album, I didn't realize this until I did this research beforehand, is a compilation from prior albums. So it's a U.S. release only.
Oh, okay.
And I actually happen to have the actual album here. Sorry, I'm turning as I
No, that's put it away. Fine. I'm looking across the table at my partner who's holding up a classic 33. Yeah. And I was going to say some of you may not know what those are, but actually in that sort of retro way where records are LPs are back.
Yeah, that's right. But people might not know it's called a 33 because there was a difference.
Yeah.
You had before, in fact. So I mentioned this was my first album, but I actually had a couple of singles, 45s.
Anybody
who doesn't know this, is the number of rotations per minute.
Yeah.
So 45s go faster. The older albums were 78s.
That's right.
And it was as the technology got better, you could make it go slower and have the same amount of information in there, music quality. But so this was a 33 and a third or whatever they called it.
So this is it. You're showing me the actual album from your youth.
Do you see the little...
Oh, you put your name on it.
Little Eric E in there. Yes. Back when I was a child and I, for whatever reason, I was writing my E's as like a C with a line in the middle.
Very stylish.
I don't know why that was.
Oh, you don't do that anymore.
No.
You've grown
out
of that.
That's not a standard part of it.
You should bring that back.
It doesn't have a liner, but boy, this is a thick piece of vinyl. I mean, this is not like records are today where they're like bendy kind of things.
I got to tell you something. It's weird. I'm already getting personal and feeling nostalgic looking at that thing because I no longer own any records, and I'm sure we'll get to that conversation later. But that's it from 1970. That's your album now.
And there's the haircuts, which, by the way, so in retro, at the time, like, I don't... There's one song I remember from it, which we'll play in a second here. The rest of the songs I sort of half remember, so maybe I just listened to one song repeatedly. but I definitely remember the picture. It's all covered in tartan, you know, the plaid.
The Bass City Rollers.
Plaid and tartan.
Tartan is a Scottish plaid.
Okay.
I'm just throwing that out there.
Their fan base was called the Tartan Horde. And they even had some tribute song and everybody. Yeah. And the fans would dress up in the plaid tartans and, you know, go see the band. And they had like what we'd call clam diggers. I think pants that didn't come all the way down to your feet kind of thing.
They didn't wear kilts?
No. I think this is more modern. Okay. But they do have all the haircuts. And I remember thinking at the time, because you can tell and look at them. I mean, it is a little bit of it's a teen band, basically.
Yeah.
You know, I just had a mental impression that certain people were certain ways. Like, this guy was the dummy. Like, he looks like the dummy there.
Yeah.
This guy was, you know, he was a quality. This guy was a cheese ball. You know, he's all like too...
I don't know. He looks like
blow dried.
He looks like the stud. And now he's the
smart guy.
Okay.
He's the goofball.
Really?
And the other big thing, there's an Eric in the band.
Eric
Longmuir.
Oh,
okay. And so I remember at the time thinking, wow, I don't know a lot of famous Erics in the world. And so this was an Eric.
We're going to put a picture of the album cover up on the blog. And you can rewind that last minute and play along and see which one you think is the stud.
On the off chance that anybody will remember this
song. Can I make a general comment about having those haircuts?
Sure.
It hides a lot of physical ills if you've got long hair.
Well, they're Scottish. So, like, right off the bat, you know, they weren't.
I think before we alienate a whole segment of our audience, although they're trying to get independent again anyway, so what do I care?
Yeah, right. Right.
Although my grandmother's Scottish, so I'm allowed to straddle both sides of the fence. I'm a quarter Scottish. And everyone's heard this.
Yeah, well, this was the biggest hit they had. I think it even went to number one in the United States. It's got a little guitar there underlying it, and they played their own instruments, so it's not like nowadays with it's just singers.
There's
it was a band at some level. They had a, when you look at the Wikipedia page, there's like 30 different members they've had like over their histories, but their core, like at this era when they were actually popular, is these five guys.
I want to actually seriously put something to your point. There does seem to be a greater integrity. The older pop is, the greater its integrity in terms of people actually singing. And even though people always talk about, and I'm going to shout out a band, the Monkees, as being like a manufactured pop band. Those guys were talented. They could play their instruments.
Right.
They could write music. I don't think that's... I'm going to be really mean, and I'm going to take some shots at modern pop music over the next two episodes, because this is a two-parter for those of you out there. I think a lot of modern pop stars probably don't have the same integrity. They've got great voices.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure they all write their own music.
And who knows if they're not great. I mean, you know, the producers have taken it over. And if, like, even on this album, so they were already at the point where they didn't write these songs. I think there's one or two of the songs they wrote, but most of them are written by the folks who produced the album.
But that's always been the way with pop, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, a lot of pop. Pop although in we're its gonna, truest term. We're going to, you know, at that point, pop was simply, you know, it was the popular music, but now pop is also almost like a genre of rock where people who write their own music may still write in a pop style.
Okay,
like we're going to talk about some albums that some bands that fit that.
Let me ask you a hardcore question about that.
A hardcore question.
Yeah, hardcore. Do you still listen to any Bay City Rollers?
I think one of the questions we should ask on each of these is, does it hold up for you? Like, you know, I don't ever, like, this was my first album, so it was not like I went out and got it. I assume it got given to me. Maybe I heard this on the radio and, you know, my parents knew I liked it, so they got it from me. It's not like I went to the store and bought this album.
Okay.
And so I can't profess, like, a deep bond with this, so it's not surprising that it doesn't hold up for me. I mean, a lot of the songs are very...
Play another song, though.
Yeah, I'm trying to find...
Because
some of them
this.
Were, like, sort of covers...
It doesn't matter. Just play anything, and I'm going to make a snap judgment as I do about most things in life, and then try and pass that snap judgment off as factual analysis.
See, this is a cover of Be My Baby.
I mean, it is. It's lightweight in that pop way, but I'm going to tell you something.
But it is a band, at least.
Yes.
It's not like just boops.
Yeah, I mean...
I actually think there's a little bit of a, like, I meant to look up and I didn't got around to look up is whether, you know, the Happy Days was around this. What year did Happy Days start?
Happy Days was like 73, 74.
So like, to some extent, I imagine they capitalized on a 50s revival that went on in the mid-50s.
I think that's true.
With these types of songs, even the ones that aren't covers are sort of similar to that kind of style.
It's interesting. So obviously, you've kept that album... Because it means something to you personally as a memento, as an artifact of your life, rather than as a piece of music. So,
I don't pop it. I don't have a photograph.
And so, I guess if we're going to end each segment with a two-pronged question, does it hold up? I mean, to be fair, I don't think that's any worse than the original version. And what's that show that people go to see on Broadway about the five tops or the four tops? Is it Frank?
You're talking about Jersey Boys?
Jersey Boys. Yeah, is it that sort of thing? I mean, it's that. What I'm saying is that style of music still has a following.
Oh, yeah.
Now, while you probably don't.
I mean, they went back on tour, apparently. They did a show, not a tour, they did a show at the end of 2015.
I
didn't get around to looking for like a
video.
Does
it still hold up right now in 2017? My answer is going to be yes.
Yeah, so it's two sort of different questions. Does it hold up in the objective, and does it hold up for a thing for you? And that's where I started by saying it isn't a thing for me to begin with, so it doesn't. It's not like that song makes me remember listening to that song repeatedly. I think I even brought this into like a show and tell one time at an elementary school, and I remember carrying it with me, and that's probably why it has the name on the front so nobody would steal it.
You know what they say? If it's not Scottish, it's crap.
There you go.
So listen to our old episodes if you want to know what that reference is. Considering that my first album, well, are we done with Bay City Rollers?
I think so.
What a bad segue. Yeah. Considering my first album was either a Sesame Street album, or for some reason I seem to recall owning the Chitty Chitty Bang Bang soundtrack.
Yeah, yeah.
I was obsessed with that film when I was a kid. I did not list any of those. And so for my first album...
It's an implicit music album, you know, like a popular music album before the word album.
In terms of us having doing our show this year, I'm glad you actually went with a true first album. Uh-huh. I didn't. With all my selections, I'm going to be upfront about this now. I picked things that sort of attempted to give myself... Again, I didn't pick the Chitty Chitty Bang Bang soundtrack because I know everyone would be reaching for the off button. So I tried to pick musical acts that spoke to me as musical acts at that time. I'm going to put it that way because we're going to run that test with each album. So I guess we're on to my first album, and I listed the first album I ever received for Christmas.
Okay, I was going to say, what's your first? I did try to take pains on each of mine. I don't know if you did, of coming up with a title first, whatever.
No, I have. I have. First, mine's have first album received for Christmas. So the Christmas of 1980, I was, you know, a teenager at the bottom end of high school. And I don't know if kids are the same these days, but I grew up in an era where you wanted to identify yourself with musical acts. We're on the back end. Punk has sort of come and quickly gone, but in its wake, it has left all kinds of, for want of a better word, garage bands come good. And this album was by a band that burst onto the scene as sort of a mod revival band. They were called The Jam. Mm-hmm. So when I say mod, their very first album, I think, is In the City. They're dressed in the long parka coats, so they look like The Who.
So
they
have, I was going to say, the mod was originally afraid, not for The Who alone, but it was, that would be the first mod.
The Who was sort of the granddaddy of the mod, but we're looking at The Who and everything that's sort of DNA related to The Who. So we're looking at The Who, we're looking at The Kinks, we're looking at, I'm trying to think of some other bands of that time who a mod would say, that's my band. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Rolling Stones, for example, because they had more of a, you know, they had a blues background, right, that type of thing. Yeah.
Their version of rock looked a little bit more backwards. It wasn't progressive. It was looking at the catalog and saying, I can do a good version of that.
So I'm not suggesting for a moment that you wouldn't like The Who and you wouldn't like The Stones as well. But I think fair's fair. Back then in their early days, you know, if you're growing up then, they are slightly different sorts of music. This band is called The Jam. This was their fifth album. It was called Sound Effects. This is still in an era when going to number one in both album or the singles charts meant something. This album got released just before Christmas, knowing that it would...
What year?
It was released in November of 1980. Okay. So my personal story is, I want that album for Christmas.
Right. Yeah, you weren't old enough to specifically ask for it, unlike mine.
I've asked for it. I am now self-identifying as, I'm into The Jam. And mm-hmm. Even though, to be fair, I liked a lot of music from that time. I think just on the horizon were Adam and the Ants and Duran Duran and some other acts that we're going to get to. But yeah, I'm like, I'm into The Jam and I like The Clash and I'm wearing that badge very proudly.
Semi-punky mod.
Yeah. So let me start playing something here on the device.
If you have any trouble, let me know. It's got a nice bass. It's not important for you to know my name, nor I to know you. We
communicate for 2 minutes only, we'll be in. So that's the biggest hit from the album. It's a song called Start, and it was notorious when it came out because if you listen to it closely, if you're a real music aficionado, it has exactly the same riff as the Beatles' Taxman.
Taxman.
Yeah. See, you can hear it now. I'll send that to you. I don't know, and there was controversy at the time whether they ripped them off or whatever, but no one from the Beatles seemed too bothered, and it's not an issue.
It's not like they had enough royalties that it would be worth the Beatles' time to come after them.
Exactly. So while this plays, I want to quickly veer away and tell a personal story about one of our fans. Back in the UK, a chap called Guy Griffiths, Guy, I'm shouting you out, he used to have a band when I was in school. And they played one night, they were all 15, 16 years of age, and they played Taxman. And he was the lead singer, and when he was singing Taxman, his voice broke like that right in the middle. And people like me ripped on him and bullied him for a couple of weeks about him
butchering Taxman. What was the age?
15, 16.
Okay.
But that's what you do when you're 15
or 16. You had a 15 or 16-year-old friend who was in a band that was performing.
While it has taken me until middle age to now do this.
Apologize?
No, I'm not apologizing. I'll never apologize anyway. But Guy, I'm going to shout you out. This is a guy who's ahead of his time musically. But
that was pretty exciting. I thought you were going to apologize.
Yeah, so there you go. No, I wasn't going to apologize. I'm gonna turn that down for a minute because I do want to play a clip of another song.
Sure.
Now, the lead singer, and if you're heavily into music now, this name might resonate with you. The lead singer of The Jam broke The Jam up a couple of years after this and formed a new band called The Style Council, which was more Motown influenced, more horns and all this type of thing. He sort of turned his back on the rock mod mm-hmm. and went off on his own to sort of
R&B.
He survives. He is still releasing albums now on a regular basis under his name, Paul Weller. Now, in England, Paul Weller is now this sort of, like, not as big a sting as internationally, but in England, he's renowned as a musician and an individual musician and the Jam, part of his career is sort of relegated to, yeah, he started the Jam a long, long time ago.
They haven't done any reunion tours or anything like that?
No. And that's Paul Weller singing now.
Now this song I know.
Do you know this song?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So this is a song that's entertainment. And I want to say this now about pop music in general. I think modern pop music is pretty terrible. Now, The Jam, while I've just given them all kinds of musical heft, there's a mod band and Motown, and I've thrown all kinds of stuff around. At the end of the day, back in England, these guys were consistently hitting the top 10 in the charts.
Sure.
So by pop standards, they were a very, very successful band.
Well, I need this.
When you listen to this song, That's Entertainment, you listen to some of the lyrics, and I'm like, yeah, pop artists don't write lyrics like this. And I'm going to
tell you
this.
No, you're right.
Yeah. I think the most famous line from that song, and that song is, this song is called That's Entertainment, and it is basically just about life.
He's just kind of like Squeeze has real stories in their songs.
But that's a great point. He's just describing the sort of working class life, and the one line that gets repeated over and over and over, or that other people quote, there's one great line where he goes, getting a cab and traveling on buses, reading the graffiti about slash seat affairs. So
I don't know what that is.
Well, he's described sitting on the bus. Now,
no, the last part,
slashed seat affairs. Now, you remember being a kid and sitting on the bus and someone's always written somewhere, you know, Joni loves Chachi this kind of thing. And then he's describing sitting on the bus, reading that. And then the fact that when you ride the bus, someone's probably torn the seat.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is that to me, I'm going to say something really, really self-indulgent. No, that's the wrong word. It's poetry as pop music.
Sentimental.
No, sentimental. What I'm saying is, I listen to modern pop plays in our backgrounds all the time. Taylor Swift, Katy Perry. I cannot remember anything, any line from any of their songs. I can remember their dance routines. I can remember whatever. Oh, Katy Perry was a blonde on the runway. But I can't remember modern lyrics from modern chart topping bands.
Yeah. Well, there's very few.
And so my point about the Jam and arguably maybe, you know, even Bay City Rollers. Well,
you're setting up a perfect segue to my next band. So this will be great.
All I'm saying is, do I think that album still holds up?
Yes,
yes I do. I think it's a great album. I think it's a great example of a follow-on from a musical trend.
Mm-hmm.
They're not a mod knockoff. They are a mod band, and they were a three-piece band: a bass drummer, Weller doing vocals and lead guitar, and a drummer. I mean, it was a true sort of garage band outfit, banging things out, and yet, you know, there were sort of adult lyrics. All their songs on all their albums are about being working class and, you know, maybe left wing and the struggles of modern life. There's a song on Sound Effects called Man in the Corner Shop, which is all about a guy who runs a corner shop and the different people who come in, and they all think that his life is better than theirs because he runs his own business. And the whole point of the song is, yeah, but I'm here, you know, 18 hours a day.
Yeah.
And like I say, modern pop doesn't talk that way. From a different album, one of the Jam's most famous singles is Smithers Jones, which is all about a fella going into work and getting the sack. I'm like, you don't do nowadays. That's
getting fired for
anybody. Getting fired. Yeah. So I'm like, yeah, so does it hold up? Yes. Has it got integrity? Yes.
Yeah.
I think it goes beyond what it was, which was pop music.
You know, it's funny. We were lining this up ahead of time and we were trying to set up, okay, what are we going to go from band to band? And you had said, okay, let's order it this way. And you have my band coming up next, which musically could not be more different and still be in the same genre. And so I was like, man, that seems a little awkward because I tend to think of that, even though that's pop, I tend to almost think of it as new wave, you know, kind of. It's not really new wave, but I think in America,
it is referred to as new wave because it was in that, again, that's what new wave was another wave of British music coming across.
But the whole catch to this one, so this is the album I'm calling, it's the first album that I wrote, quotes, spoke to me, because it has like mind you, this was my teenage self again. A bunch of these things are all coming from earlier age because they are first albums. They're not last albums of something. This is the album Signals by Rush. And like, especially as a young teenager in the suburbs, this is what the entire album is basically about. You know, it's and I mean, the first album, I'm going to go right to the first song just because it's called Subdivisions, which in Canadian speak, at least, is suburbs.
Oh, I didn't know they were Canadian.
Yeah.
There you go.
It explains a lot of differences. Obviously, musically, completely different thing, but the entire song is about a kid who's like sort of lost in the suburbs.
Yeah.
Or people lost in the suburbs and kids drinking in basements. And,
so what year did this come out?
1982.
So we're right in there.
Yeah, it's right in there. That's the other part is like a time-wise, I was like, do these line up? And they in fact do line up, which is kind of crazy. So for me, this is like the first album I had where I had my own record player in my bedroom.
Okay.
And I would listen to this thing like repeatedly. And there's like a couple of songs, like for whatever reason, I really identify with Summertime. I don't know. And maybe that I had first gotten it in the summertime. Let's see. I'm trying not to get to a lyrics kind of thing, but.
No. Here we go.
It's the suburbs. It's in between the two things. And it's just nowhere is the dreamer or the misfit so alone kind of thing. You know, it's a whole bit about that. And so maybe
Spirit
I was being
of Radio on that album?
No, Spirit of Radio is a much earlier album.
Okay.
Much earlier
I want to say, it's not my, Rush in general is not my sort of music, but I truly respect the fact that you've selected it and for the reason you've just given about the lyrics attempting to do more than puppy love. It's about some, you know, alienation, angst, not fitting in, or classic sort of teenage themes. Spirit of Radio is the one Rush song that I do own, and I love it. And it speaks to me because it's just about radio. And as I said, I think on our last show,
and it has very great lyrics. I mean, so Neil Peart, the drummer, wrote all the lyrics. It was, you know, in contrast to the Bay City Rollers, who had 80-minute lyrics, they've had basically three members their entire life. Their first album, they had a different drummer, but he left immediately after recording that first album, and the first album sounds just like a Led Zeppelin knockoff. And then they kind of moved over to this prog rock element, and this was the first one where they started really heavily mixing in synthesizers, and a bunch of people gave them a hard time for it at the time, but the lyrics all written by Neil Peart, who is a big Ayn Rand fan, and like, so there's the earlier albums about like oppressive state, like 2112 is a whole thing about like somebody in the future, oppressive government type of arrangement, finding a guitar and all that. So they're all concept albums. This isn't as heavy-handed a concept album, but it's thematic. Like all the different parts are similar things in that regard.
You've seen them live, right?
Oh yeah, a bunch of times.
And when they play, obviously, I know as bands. As you grow up with bands and they continue to play, I think sometimes they get caught between playing their new stuff and just playing the old stuff. When you've heard the old stuff, does it still...
Yeah, so the funny thing
about
them...
You still react to it.
This is a band that started also in the late 60s. This came out in 82, but it had been going for a little while already. They, at the time new albums would come out... That was always the case because, you know, they did another dozen albums after this one. And each time they came out with a little bit more electronic, a little bit almost more like Yes or late era Get Yes or Genesis or things like that, that there were a bunch of people who said, I only like old Rush because it had more rock and roll and it was better than that. But now it's been so long. First of all, back then when you toured, you'd play like all of the new album songs and you like a bunch of your old songs would roll off and you had a fixed playlist and everybody assumed you wanted to hear the last album. So you get a lot of complaints at that time. But now it's all part of the past, you know, and everybody who's going there is older. And even the ones who are younger appreciate them in a broader spectrum. They didn't have that sense of, oh, this band left me by changing in a different way. And so you look at the whole thing and plus they play a mix, you know, they realize they're not going to just play a bunch of songs off their new album if they have a new album at the time. So now going to concerts, I think I went a couple of years ago with one of our friends, and it was just a big mix of all different things.
I take it you still listen to that album?
By the way, I should mention, I have this
one. You have it too?
I have this one on record as well. It's obviously not what we're playing. The one difference is, so this one now, this is when we start getting the inside liner, has all the, you know,
lyrics,
extra pieces and electronic stuff. We've got a little map of the suburbs on the back here, so that's more entertaining.
I got to tell you something. I do miss... I download
it. Yeah, full on album.
I download everything now, and we're going to have that conversation probably in part two, where I talk about a certain album that I've owned in all formats. But I do miss the album. Were you one of those people who would, the first time you had it and you're listening, and if you had an album where they had the words,
you'd read it all over there. I mean, it was, I mean, now, maybe that's part of it. Like, at that time, these words meant something.
Yes.
Like, this song was, like, about, like, I mean, the whole begins with a kid sitting in the grass and, like, look at this guy. I'm like, this was my summertime thing in my head. And like, the lyrics seem to mean something. Now meanwhile, I will
just... Now, hold on a minute. What do you mean the lyrics seem to mean something? Well, do they mean something or they not? Because I'm not...
No. They mean something. You're being thrown away. But the difference is, they don't mean something to the indeterminate middle age that I am now. They mean something to me now because they meant something to me then, if that makes any sense.
Okay.
Because, like, now I wouldn't listen to this and think... I don't identify with the kid in the suburbs.
Sure.
I'm not a kid in the suburbs anymore. But I remember identifying with the kid in the suburbs. So it has its own resonance. It's like it's reverberating through everything.
Yeah, I mean, I want to say this. And again, it's funny. We thought of all these albums that we're picking in pairs and how to talk to things back to back. And we had not sort of pre-showed any link between my choice of The Jam and your choice of Rush. I will say this about The Jam's lyrics across the board. They still ring true. They might speak of a slightly different era, but they still ring true. And I would never, but I understand what you're saying. You're not being throwaway about the lyrics.
No.
I mean, but I'll say this about, you know, The Jam talked about a lot of things about, you know, sort of, you can see sort of the first inklings of someone's political viewpoint. I don't look at it. I may look back at it and go, yeah, it's really 1980s, but I don't look back on it in any way and go, you know, and it's funny enough to talk about the album I just talked about. Paul Weller is known as sitting in a certain space on a political spectrum. It's interesting. It'd be interesting to see if you could ever hear the guys from Rush now.
Like talking about
this. Do they still? And I would suspect they do. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but they were also younger too. Like, so the one song on the album that does sort of have more of a grown-up resonance is, which sounds, I mean, it sounds a little bit cheesy at this point now. But it's much more about, like, adults losing their abilities. Like, talking about a dancer who can't dance anymore. And, like, this is a... So, and this uses a Hemingway lyric, "For you the blind who once could see, the bell tolls for thee."
Yeah.
And it's all about, like, you know, like, losing the things you could do before.
I'm not entirely convinced. I'm now going to make one of my super general sweeping statements. I'm not as convinced that modern lyrics of more popular music...
Yeah, mind you, this never got popular the way The Jam did, but...
No! What, The Jam were popular in the UK, they were not popular here.
Yeah, but this wasn't going to get to charts up here.
I don't think, and it's interesting, I don't want to be a spoiler, because we're going to come... You've picked a U2 album.
Yeah.
As much as U2... I'm not entirely convinced that U2's lyrics... in general have as much heft as some of this stuff does.
Well, you know, it's different. It's not... The U2 lyrics, at least as far as you can tell, are not as personal. They got a more... Political is too simple a word, but it's more like global-eyed, you know, in terms of things. And we're going to come around to that because, in fact, the album we're going to talk about... But I do want to... Actually, now that you mentioned U2 and you've previewed it, I don't mind saying this. The one thing I want to mention about both this... Rush and U2 were two bands that I started following in that era. And the real reason I did...
See, I love the way you use that word, following, because I'm... We're of a generation where you followed them
exactly.
Back.
Exactly. It was like a team. When I was in junior high school, I had a friend, Pete. I'm sure Pete doesn't listen to the Atlantic Voice podcast. He wouldn't know where I live or that it was
I'll put the boot into him. Why not, Pete?
Yeah,
Pete. Get your act together.
Pete had an older brother, Les. Now, it was an interesting family. Since he's not going to listen, I don't think this would be anything bad. His parents had immigrated from Hungary when the Soviets took over in like the 70s and sort of took things over there, maybe in the 60s, whatever it was. They came to America. They owned a car garage, you know, just general repairs to the car place. They lived in a nice house up on a big hill that used to be, it was originally a schoolhouse, and they had converted into a place to live. They had a German Shepherd that when you'd come up to the house, we pull up in a Volvo, and at that time the Volvo, it was the big tank of a Volvo, so the windowsills were high, but the dog would come up and just put his, rest his chin in your window as you came in there. Nicest dog in the world. Their grandfather was living with them, and he didn't even speak any English, and he didn't have much to do, so he taught the dog to only take treats from one hand. Like, so if you had it in your right hand, I forget the dog's name, the dog would take the treat from you. If it was in your left hand, he would just sit there waiting and waiting until you put it into your right hand.
I gotta tell you something. That you've just destroyed a whole lot of stereotypes for me for people that repair old cars and have a large dog that guards the car.
He taught me how to shoot BB guns, and we used to ride our bikes to the beach, and he would strap a big boom box on the back of his rack of the bicycle.
Really?
And we would ride up to the beach, which was not too far away on a regular basis. Anyway, so his older brother had a Rush album, Moving Pictures, which had already come out by the time I saw it, which was the album that precedes this one. And he had, there's something weird in my timeline. He had something about U2, but then the next album I'm going to talk about comes out after this. So those were two albums I said, well, let me check that out. I mean, they couldn't be more different from each other in terms, again, of music styles.
Yeah.
But I think I was somewhat ahead of the curve in like grabbing a band because you had an older brother, which I guess is what happens to most people. They have some older friends who like into something, and then you get into it. Not the way you get into the Bay City Rollers.
No.
So anyway, thanks to Pete and Les, and appreciate it because they introduced me to some good music.
I'm going to shout out two old friends of mine, Doug and Tony, who all the bands you just named there in terms of your discussion about Yes and Rush and prog rock, they knew all these bands.
Yeah.
They were all the way in.
Yeah.
And in a strange way, as I get older, I really appreciate that sort of knowledge at a young age. And again, I'm spending a lot of time this episode sort of putting the boot into the new generation. I don't think the new generation feel exactly the same way about their musical trends.
No, they might all, when they go to college or something later on, they'll look at that stuff nostalgically, but I don't know if they'll look at it meaningfully. Although, maybe I'm doing too glib, because I will say that there are a couple of pop tunes. I mean, like a couple of Miley Cyrus tunes and a couple of other tunes, they don't have the same themes, but they do have a theme that resonate with a millennial more, like Katy Perry song, but a lot of personal empowerment type of songs. I don't know about any.
I don't know, but I just feel I never hear kids nowadays say
Justin Timberlake is singing stuff like that. But
I never hear kids nowadays say I follow Justin Timberlake.
No,
I
don't want to pick on
Justin Timberlake. I think he's terrific.
Now the other thing is, realize at that time there was such a more of a filter. Like you just weren't going to get exposed to many different bands,
that's
and so everything's come through that sieve, and they've already been sort of filtered out. Nowadays, there's just such a wide range of different things. You would never really go whole hog on any one music source because there's just too many different things out there.
All right, so let's move on.
Yep, you're next.
My the next one, and as I play this, check it out now. The funk soul brother, right about now. The funk soul brother, right about now. About now. About now. About now. So this is Fatboy Slim's The Rockefeller Skank from his album On the Floor at the Boutique, which technically is On the Floor at the Boutique Live, and I never knew this was a live album. Well, but I've picked this album for slightly different reasons than one would think. I like Fatboy Slim. He is in the top echelon of the celebrity DJ, so I'm talking about people like Paul Oakenfold and Mark Ronson, guys who spent a career working the circuit.
Yeah.
Mixing other people's tunes in front of a dance audience, then taking that stuff into the studio and creating albums of their own. I personally think this is one of his best albums.
What's this, the first of?
I'm going to get to that.
Okay, I didn't realize.
The reason I picked this album is, and because this is where I want to, this is where I'm going to take our conversation. This is the first album I bought after hearing it in a bar. So I used to go, when this album was new, and this album was released in 98, so we're talking late 90s, after work I would hang out in a pub, a bar restaurant called Au Pied du Cochon in Washington, D.C. It no longer exists. It was famous because apparently back in the 70s and 80s it was used as a CIA, Russian, all kinds of stuff.
One of those. Point or something.
Yes, things like that. Anyway, I remember sitting there one Friday night, and this is playing in the background, and I said, to the barman.
This song in particular, I assume?
This album, I don't know. Okay. They played the whole album. And it was the first time I ever said to the bartender, whose name was David, from Scotland, funnily enough, and I said, what is this? And he said, oh, it's Fatboy Slim on the floor of the boutique. So I memorized it and went out and bought it. My point here I was going to make was, I think Shazam is one of the greatest inventions ever. Shazam is the app you can put on your phone.
There's more than it. SoundHound, and you can actually do it with Google search on your phone. If you, at least with an Android phone, you just press this microphone thing.
So what I'm saying, yeah, this is my first exposure to the celebrity DJ. I was never into stuff like... I was behind the curve on things like big beat and house music and all those sort of things, these genres that other people knew about that I didn't. So I remember when I heard this and I bought it, I suddenly thought that I had joined, I'm now officially into the big beat club. I now know stuff, and I went and bought all of Fatboy Slim's albums. But like I say, I heard it in the pub, and I turned to the barman who was in charge of the music and said, what is it? And he told me. And the interesting thing is, nowadays with modern technology, to the point you just made talking about how people are exposed to music. We are exposed to music in very different ways now than we used to. I'm constantly going places. If music's playing in the coffee shop when I'm buying my coffee or wherever, I will whip out my phone and I will, for me, Shazam it. And the next thing you know, I'm making a purchase or buying an album. But I like this album in that, like a lot of these DJs, yes, it's all sampled, it's all mixed, it's all kinds of different things, but the genius is, people are very, and we're going to have some extensive conversations about sampled music in the second episode of this back-to-back. I think people are very dismissive about this type of music, and yet ultimately, the more you listen to it, the more you get the genius of it. And I'm going to play now something else. This is... This is from the same album. This is Michael Jackson. I don't know. I don't know what the lyrics are, but I feel like dancing. This is actually a Fatboy Slim original, which I don't know what it means. And
the name of the song is Michael Jackson?
The name of the song is Michael Jackson, but the credits to the song are all Fatboy Slim's. And what I mean by that is, when you look at the playlist, the... On the Florida Boutique has 19 different tracks, and most of them, either in what the track is called or in how it's credited, give a huge shout out to the original source of the sample. So, for example, the opening song on the Florida Boutique is Fatboy Slim's remixed version of Apache. On the album, it's Apache, and it's not credited as Fatboy Slim's. He gives credit to the original writer of the song, which is quite rare.
One thing is legal. I mean, like, the thing is, he's DJing. He's not doing a remix where he's sampling. Okay. He's DJing their stuff, and so I don't think he can claim credit for writing these songs.
No,
but essentially performing the record.
Yeah, maybe that's true. But I don't know, for example, when...
See, this is a topic we could have researched ahead of time.
We should have. But anyway...
But I imagine that's got to be... I don't think it's because out of the benevolence of his heart. Maybe to some of it. But I think he would run into trouble. If you take an album and you're just doing the DJ treatment, you're not sampling a piece and you're putting it into a whole different context kind of thing. I think you'd run into trouble if you said, oh, that's my song now.
That's interesting. Because again, this song that's been playing... It is just his.
Yeah, well, this...
But I don't know how he's put it together.
Well, maybe it must maybe have been, more like a hip-hop tune.
It must have been put together or a whole load of other things.
Yeah, or either that, or you can play a couple of notes into a machine, and then you can take that and mess it around. So now it seems like it's a sort of... In fact, I think that's the way a lot of hip-hop works today. It is not brought from other prior sources because in part of the legal issues, and because in part they ultimately developed a technology to be like, well, I can develop a hook that's as good as these hooks I got on these records I grabbed out of a bin somewhere.
So I'm going to make this point now. I was going to make it in part two when we were talking about a couple of hip-hop albums, but I'm going to make this point now. Unlike you, I'm not a huge fan of live music. I don't enjoy it because live music never sounds like it does on the record.
Just put that on the checklist of your flaws, but
yeah, that's fine. That's one reason why I really like stuff like this. No, let me take that back. I'm not a fan of live music because I struggle with live music that doesn't sound like it sounds like like it does on the record. Mm-hmm. Even using that terminology makes me very old-fashioned. I have absolutely no... There is nothing about my musical taste where I feel like it needs to be played live. And what I mean by that is...
I was about to say, the difference is the type of music that you're listening to. Like, yes. If the type of music is, like, even like a Rush thing, I don't... Going to see live, it's not that big a deal because the best version of those tunes, other than the fact that they seem live's nice loud machine, but the best version of those tunes is the ones that's recorded and it's been honed down to that stuff. But there's a lot, and we're going to cover some of them, where the live performance is just inherently better, and because it's got more spirit behind it.
But what I'm saying is, as a fan, as a consumer, I don't have any hang up about how the music has been presented to me. I like stuff that's produced.
No, that's fine. I'm not against it, I'm just saying it's not necessary. But that's a lot of it has to do with that's why you'd like them better. Now, the one thing I want to ask about this is, do you feel like it holds up? Like, there are definitely this falls into a genre. I'll tell you my version, then you can tell your version.
Ooh, but yeah,
it falls into a really genre. It's not unlike things I would have listened to in that same time frame, or maybe a little bit earlier, you know, the Happy Mondays and some things like that, where... And actually, this goes true for a lot of music nowadays that I listen to, that it has its own, when it comes out, it has a sound that is unique, and you go, ooh, I want to hear what that is.
Yes.
But then, like, 2 years later, after you've listened to it, you go, well, it's not new anymore, and it doesn't, to my mind, doesn't really hold up in and of itself enough for me to want to go back to it. I still occasionally go back to it, but like, for example, there's another, again, it's not this album I'm coming after, but things that sound I'll throw a single into like a mix or something like that, but I would never sit down and listen to that album again.
I have like six of, you know, the thing with these DJs is, this is the one thing I don't like about them. Bands release albums, it's all relatively identifiable. Because DJs are constantly performing and remixing stuff, I have six or seven of his albums, but that's no way near his complete discography.
Right.
Well, which irritates me a little bit as a fan, in that I can never completely get my arms around it. Does it hold up? I don't listen to it a lot. When I do listen to it, I really enjoy it.
Yeah, which is not a... But I mean, this podcast isn't about what holds up for you. The podcast is about first albums, but so we don't... There's no aspersions on it.
But in part of the conversation, does it hold up? I don't... It doesn't hold up to the extent that I want to continually listen to it and all of his stuff. But when I hear it, I go, oh my God, it's Fatboy Slim. I need to break one of those out.
Right.
Which is
you
not
need to do is make mixed lists that have one of those tunes on there.
Yes. And so it is an interesting, and I don't know, and maybe this is the same about a lot of that type of music, the DJ'd music, the processed music, for want of a better term. Your relationship with it is very different than your relationship with, you know, some of the other albums that we've talked about, or will talk about, or other albums that we listen to. It's interesting. I never sit there and go, now here's the point. I never sit there and go, oh, that's so 2001. I don't. It still seems new and cutting edge, yet I don't continually feel the need to reach for it.
Right.
And so, it's an interesting question. Yeah. So there you go. It's Fatboy Slim. First music I ever heard in a bar and went and bought.
All right.
Yeah.
So we previewed it before, but my next album is going to be from U2, and it's War, which would have been about, so we're jumping back in time, because that was, what, 97 or 98 or something that came out. So we're going backwards back to my
to your youth.
Junior high era.
Junior high
into high school era. February 1983, this album came out. And this is what really throws me off, because that would have been as I was getting out of junior high. And yet I feel like I knew about... this was the first album... This is not my first of it, but it's the first album where like it was coming out and I went and got it when it got released. So maybe that's the whole explanation. But... I'm calling this my first cool album, because while the other album spoke to me and some other ones do that, Rush was never going to be cool. Like, it may be a small segment, but as a general, put it this way.
Okay.
It's not going to be cool with girls.
No,
I can tell you that. Nobody's going to be like, oh, no. That Eric, he's such a catchy, he listens to a lot of Rush.
Yeah.
Whereas U2, that was actually hip and cool. And it, particularly at that point in time, was ahead of the curve.
This is what they're going to say. They're going to say, oh, Eric, he's still got that Bay City Rollers haircut.
right. I wish I had a Bay City Rollers hat. I had the worst haircuts as youth. But this first song is by far not the most popular song of this album. We'll mention a couple of those, but the one thing about this song is this is one you know, some of the other, our common, in fact, the person who introduced us originally, we used to go on these ski trips. We go on these bus ski trips when we were in junior high school and high school. And we would play this. We played this on the back. And I remember distinctly playing this on a boombox so that like half the bus could hear it, and people being like, what the hell are you listening to? It doesn't make any sense. You know, they want to listen to their like cheese stuff, whatever it was. But here. Not one of the biggest U2 songs of all time, The Refugee, which I think one of the few songs that wasn't actually written by them.
Does this album have I Will Follow on it?
Yeah.
Okay.
No. That's the...
Is that the one before? That's Boy.
Yeah, but that's two before.
That's two before. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the gist of this song. Now, the big songs in this, I'm just going to jump right to them because we can do that. The biggest songs of this are Sunday Bloody Sunday and New Year's Day.
Of course, yeah. Yeah.
And so this was stuff where, like, you know, I embraced this album, this band, because it was different. It was deeper. Like, you know, we talked about lyrics. It didn't speak to me like a suburban kid, but it was like, it was turning almost global. I can't believe.
But the lyrics are political.
Right. But they're not overtly political in the sense of like picking a side, and I think they would have denied a lot of but it's much more like grandiose, which of course is what Fano's all about.
I do feel that U2 are a group, you can just let it play. U2 are a group that all of us have some, I can't think there's many people on the planet that do not have some sort of relationship with U2. You've heard their songs, you've seen them at the Super Bowl, you've watched Bono on TV being interviewed by Nelson Mandela or whatever it may be. Right. All of us, it's weird, U2 are like that sort of, they are the Kevin Bacon 6 degrees of life, and that everyone has a touch of U2. It's funny though, this is the album where I feel they kind of suddenly went beyond genre. And what I mean by that is, when U2 started, they were like new wave Spandau Ballet, in that they were another act, they were from Ireland, they were wearing certain gear, like a lot of popular bands of the 80s, early 80s, you were fashioned up a certain way, meaning you're wearing a certain jacket, you had your certain haircut. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah.
All the new waves.
I know what you're saying, but I think you're going to be off by one album. But in fact, this is some of the stuff we're going to talk about here in a second. Okay.
For me, I feel like this. It's this song and this album where suddenly they make the jump to being a take them seriously as a rock band.
They become more of a casual,
U2 fan. To me, this is the moment where you really start taking them seriously as a musical act.
I've got a number of words written down here. So, like, the one that goes with what you're saying is they became anthematic or anthemic.
There you go.
These songs all become things that you can sing along to in a huge, huge arena.
Yes.
But they weren't playing huge arenas at this point. I mean, this was, maybe they played some basketball arenas, but they weren't playing stadiums or anything at this point.
I think their biggest one, didn't they play it? Is it Red Rocks? What's that?
Well, this album came out, they come out with Live in Red Rocks. Yeah. And so this is the other reason it becomes a cool thing, is because, first of all, this one has videos. It's on MTV.
Yep.
You know, they've got the guys on the horses in the snow. They got the hair. I mean, it's just a whole different thing than that was going on. At least in terms of reaching us. You're right. I mean,
New Year's Day, the horses in the snow?
Yeah, maybe. No, that's on this album too. Yeah, so, you know, I'll throw that on there just for this.
So I still feel at this moment they are throwing off their Spandau Ballet shackles.
Yeah. And a bunch of people, I think, gave them a hard time. I mean, in retrospect, I think this album's a bigger deal than it was. But a bigger deal looking back at the time, I think some people gave it a hard time. But, you know, I also, it was one of the first, it's the first band that I saw in a real deal concert. Like, I saw some musicians, and I saw Harry Chapin, and I saw some other things when I was younger with parents. But this was the first one where the parents dropped us off at Nassau Coliseum up on Long Island. And I can't remember. I think we went along with a couple of girls, and it was me and the other friend that you know of. I remember one of the girls had brought a jar with gin. Snuck it out of the liquor cabinet at our house, kind of thing. I had the world's greatest. I had this. I picked up in the concert in the parking lot. I picked up it was basically a button down black shirt with a huge silk screen of the war album cover on the back.
Oh, wow.
I do not know where this went. I mean, to this day, I blame somebody in my household must have thrown it away, because I would take that out now and wear it if it was available.
You've got to eBay that thing and see if you can find one. Amazon, eBay.
It was clearly just made by, it was like an Arrow shirt. You know, it was like a real dress shirt that somebody had just silk screened on the back. So I guess I could probably arrange to make one myself or something like that.
That's all part of following music.
But I will say, that tour, though, that was not the War tour. That was the Unforgettable Fire tour. So following bands. So okay. I pick them up before this album comes out, and I'm listening to Boy in October, which were the albums that came out beforehand. Then War comes out. That's the one, like, I'm, you know, ready to grab it as soon as it gets released. Unforgettable Fire comes out next, and after that is Joshua Tree. And by the time Joshua Tree comes out, I'm in late high school, and oddly enough, I sort of pivoted away from that, in part because it became more popular. Like, I grabbed it the same reason people drive Saabs and Volvos. It was something different and interesting. And as soon as everybody liked it, I was like, well, it's not fun anymore. When I'm not pissing off somebody at the back of the bus by playing a weird drum thing, I'm not interested in playing this anymore. Plus, the music got more accessible. You know, they did that thing where it was like they're Americanizing it, where they had B.B. King and all these things. And I said, this is not as interesting to me anymore.
There is a weird sort of ownership thing when you're, I think at any level with music, in that what you listen to, you hope reflects not just your taste, but your ability to sort of get out and sort of process and go, yes, actually, that's really, you haven't heard it, I'm telling you right now, that's really good. That is an innate part of following music.
Yeah.
And to your point, when everyone else gets it, then you're kind of done with it, because no one wants to hear that you were the first guy to listen to it.
Yeah.
We all just want to be the only guy listening.
Because you're not really saying anything different if everybody's saying the same thing.
And it's funny, I've always... Part of the sort of the modern ability now to just... No, not modern. I think even though I've only ever now bought singles and downloaded single songs from U2, they're never a band where I felt I've needed to buy the album, but I own a lot of their music.
Right.
And that's interesting, just my relationship with them. So with what you've just said, do you still listen to them now when they're doing stuff? Like, what didn't they have that disaster of a free iTunes album that no one liked and thought was rubbish?
So they had an album before that one, which I did listen to.
And I'm not and putting the boot into
it. Yeah, no. Right. Going back, I actually kind of like some of the... I liked Unforgettable Fire at the time, but Unforgettable Fire and Joshua Tree, I like those better than some songs from this. They then went into that very much more like Zootopia, weird things where they try to call the president from stage, and it was much more jumbly, and I never have really embraced that piece of it. And then they came back to something that was more in tune with their roots. It doesn't sound like this, but it's still, and plus it's like an adult version. It's like the 45-year-old version of U2. It was pretty embraceable, and then they did tours where they mixed them all together. But now I'm back to it's too big, and I don't like my bands that big.
So I'm gonna, instead of asking you, do you still listen to it? And does
I would listen to this? I'll listen to it completely. Yeah. I mean, there's no trouble.
That's a gimme.
I meant to segue from your Fatboy Slim to this thing. Like, listen, you can't say that this doesn't hold up. I mean, I could listen to that album front to back.
So I'm gonna hit you with a different question. Have you two jumped the shark?
They can't. I mean, it's not. They would jump the shark if they didn't change. This is the other thing that's interesting about bands, right? Can you name a band that changes anymore? Like, maybe they're just not around long enough to change, but like that really is transitioning in their sound that you could look at the beginning and their ending and be like, gosh, it's like completely different.
Each album they're coming out with a different sound. The business doesn't allow them.
Yeah.
And if they change, they suck. That's my. We can't do a music show.
The fact that these bands could transition in a way that would alienate old fans and yet pick up new fans. I mean, that is bold artistic maneuvering that nobody would be allowed to do anymore. Like the idea that you would, you know, if you're Adele, you're going to move on to a different sound. Nobody's going to let you move on to a different sound.
No, and I was going to say, you know, we can't do a music show without me putting the boot into Sting. So I'm just going to put the boot into Sting for constantly changing and doing whatever. I've been thinking about this line for about 6 months, and we now have a music show. I can say it. For me, Sting is the musical equivalent of a theme restaurant. It's all a knockoff of everything else and not as good as the original. And he is one artist who was great and now sucks. because the police are still brilliant. But anyway,
have you listened anymore?
I just needed to segue in to put the boot into Sting.
So,
so let's move on.
Yeah, I think
quick interlude. I'm going to change pace a little bit.
Yeah.
Sugar on it. Oh yes, please. Right, signing off now. Cheers. GLK London calling CX3 Birmingham. Come in, Birmingham.
This is Birmingham. I'm receiving you. Come in, London.
Hello, Harry.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Fine. Harry, do us a favour, will you? Nip round to my mother's and ask her to make me a bread pudding.
Will do. Are you ready for the game?
Ready for the game? Yes. Right, six. One, two, three, four, five, six. Up the ladder. Square 46, another go. Three, one, two, three, down the snake, back to square 27.
Right, I'll have my goals for the night.
How's the weather up there?
Pelting down it is.
What a pity. It's not raining in Tokyo.
I know. I've just been speaking to him.
Well, good luck to you. He can't even understand me. I don't know how he manages with you.
You are listening to Tony Hancock.
Uh-huh.
Now, for most people, this doesn't mean anything.
No, I had a hard time figuring what the heck they were talking about until they started talking about Chutes and Ladders, although it's called something else different there.
Tony Hancock was a English comedian who's big on the BBC in the late 50s, and then when they transitioned to TV, he had a TV show, and then he committed suicide, I think, in the late 60s. He was a comic genius. I grew up listening to Tony Hancock. My mother loved him. She had all these tapes and cassettes. Tony Hancock, this is the first comedy album I ever owned.
Yeah.
And
to what year is this album from?
This album is from like the 1961, and it's actually a special with two episodes of his radio series. One, he goes to give blood, and on the next one, he is called...
Blue tits have been at the top of my milk again. Look at my gold.
He's a radio hand.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, here we go.
They must have beaks like pneumatic drills.
So he's complaining about the birds who have been on his area.
I will not have great feathered heads stuck in my milk bottles, guzzling the cream.
And there's a line coming up here that I want us to listen to
that
and then I'm going to talk
it's
about.
Her who encourages them round here. Her and her coconut shells and bits of bacon rind hanging around all over the place. They've been at my farmhouse as well. Look at it, great feet marks all over it. It's not good enough. Birds have no right to be in towns. Why don't they stay in the country where they belong? Wait till one of them perches on my area with a lump of my bread in his mouth. I'll shove a few hundred volts through it. That'll make his feet tingle.
So, he was a 50s and 60s British comedian, and he had a radio sitcom. And the minute I use that word sitcom, I know, depending who you are and how you watch TV, all kinds of different things go through your head. If you take time to listen to Tony Hancock, he's not sitcom in, like, you know, Big Bang Theory. He is sitcom in that when you listen to him, he plays a middle-aged guy who's just a working man. Stuff's always going wrong. It tends not to end well. You can see in Tony Hancock, you see the forerunner for people like Al Bundy. You see Larry David and George Costanza's character,
mm-hmm.
someone who you think they've kind of got their act together, but it tends to go wrong, and there's this sort of, you know, irony of their existence. I see a little bit of Tony Hancock and Louis C.K. talking about regular life, and Louis C.K. does his thing with his kids and life, and stuff's always going wrong. It means something to me personally, because like I said, my mother used to love this stuff.
Yeah.
And I used to listen to her tapes, and if it was ever on the BBC in reruns, I would listen to it. And even now, if I go to the BBC iPlayer, I can dig up old Tony Hancock's. And I still buy the albums and I keep them. And if I'm doing a long drive, I'll put them in the car and I'll listen to a half hour Tony Hancock show. One, because it makes me laugh. Two, it makes me think of my youth. Three, I'm only saying this as a recommendation to people. If you like listening to the spoken word, give this guy a go, listen to it three times and get a feel for his character. And he was a comic genius in the same way that you watch Louis C.K. and you go, that's genius. Or you watch Larry David and you go, that's genius. I think Jerry, I watch Seinfeld all the time and I think it's hilarious and it's very, very clever, but I don't think Jerry Seinfeld's persona as a comedian.
No, well,
genius it is was unfair. But what I mean is there is something about comedians who take everyday existence and get laughs out of the things that are normally, it's that Hancock for me was one of the forerunners from quaint 1950s and 60s England who understood the pain in comedy. And
you know, I assume you had the Honeymooners as a big, you know, beginning thing.
Okay.
Like there's a lot of sitcoms in America that would have been family driven ones, you know, that are
and
not.
That's what I'm saying.
But that's different.
Yes.
But this, like a honeymoon, this seems more like inspired by the Honeymooners, where it's like just these couples trying to get along. I mean, those are couples, but I see where, I mean, like he was a bus driver in the Honeymooners, you know?
So anyway, one of the reasons I picked this was because I kind of knew that you wouldn't pick anything spoken word.
Well, you know, it's interesting. So, you know, am I allowed to
steal
some ground?
No,
I did a little searching, didn't
yeah,
I? Because I had a first comedy album.
Okay, let's do
but
it.
But the difference between the two is going to be, I don't know if it will explain anything about our personalities, because I'm actually sort of really interested in this element that this is something you would like, because it's pretty straight, you know, like it's good in that it's, you know, it's working man and things like that, but it's not, well, this guy.
You paid $4? $4.50? Believe me, sometimes, yeah, it's a good investment. Sometimes I come out here, I do $4.75 show. I might do a $5 show, so yeah. I never, if you pay $4.50, I don't do a $4.25 show. I keep going. I do a $4.50 show, and that's it, baby. So you may make a little bread off this tonight. I'm into bread. I love money. I love everything about money. I love to eat it. Eat money. You say you can't take it with you? I'm taking it with me. I'm into bread. I love bread. I bought some pretty good stuff. Got me a $300 pair of socks. I got a fur sink. Oh, let's see. Electric dog polisher. That was a good one. Gasoline powered turtleneck sweater. And of course, I bought some dumb stuff too, you know.
Anyway, so it's Steve Martin. And
okay.
This was my Let's Get Small was the album. And I'm going to guess probably right around 1980. It was before Wild and Crazy Guy with the arrow through his head. Although you can see he's got the arrow through his head there. But it's before that got big. He's even got dark hair in this one still. He'd not turned white haired yet. But it's much more bizarro humor. And it's a little bit of stoner stuff.
Here's a big difference.
Stand-up, too. I mean, it's obviously a totally different genre.
But here's a big difference, I think, in certain comedians. Steve Martin, I think Chris Rock is probably the same. And I'm not trying to pick people who you don't sort of put together. But Billy Crystal. These are all comedians that you laugh with. They're funny and you laugh with them. Tony Hancock, Tony Hancock, and I'm now trying to bring it back. Tony Hancock, as in Larry David's characters or Louis C.K., you laugh with them, but at a certain moment, you're also laughing at them and that predicament. And I think that's why I like Hancock, because he is obviously, from a different era. But he has that pathos about him whose predicaments you laugh at.
It's obviously different stuff, but I just think of what you're choosing to find funny, I find weird funnier.
Okay.
But it's also a big difference between stand-up and sketch comedy.
I would recommend this album to someone.
Like Louis K's stand-up is not the same as when he's on. Like if you see a stand-up, it's just, you know, you're laughing with him on things.
But what I'm saying is
But I also think that I'm not entirely sure that the distinction holds water, because when you say laughing, you're not laughing at him. You're empathizing, I assume, with his stories. You're empathizing with, for sure, Larry David and Louis C.K. in terms of their characters. Most of the times you're laughing. You're not really, you're laughing at what happens, but you're laughing because you know a version of that that's happened to you.
But that's what I'm saying. And Hancock was one of the first where 9 out of every 10 episodes, it didn't end as you thought. He doesn't win the lottery, and do you know what I mean? Right. And that's there is two sort of broad forms of humor, and a lot of guys was always feel with Eddie Murphy, for example, and I know stand-up is different.
What?
That there is a different...
His stuff is you're like, left look how cool I am. Like, he's the class clown. He's doing these things in front of everybody. Some respects,
there are winners and
is.
Losers in comedy. Some people get their laughs from being the loser. Right. Some people get their laughs from being the winner. I know that's a very broad and a very simplistic way of putting it. All I'm saying is Hancock was the forerunner of people.
Yeah. Eddie Murphy certainly does not make himself look foolish when he's telling a story about... Like, he'll tell stories about things that happen. Obviously, they're all comic stories. You know, who knows what's... But he's never going to tell a story that involves him being on the short end of the stick. He tells a story about, like, his mom hit him with a shoe, but he's not like... It's all about how funny this story
how
is.
Funny
it's not
it
about
is,
like oh
how,
boy, look
how
at
how
me
my
kind
life
of thing.
Was, yeah.
And Steve Martin wouldn't do the stuff where it's Louis C.K. will do more of that, like, oh my God, you know, like, look at how my family's treating me and that kind of stuff.
You're willing to make yourself the punchline.
Yeah.
And so let me ask you a question, because I intentionally picked a spoken word album because I do tend to buy comedy now and again or stuff like that.
First of all, I don't know what you're doing buying. You know, I think you don't.
I download, whatever the word. I don't do books.
Well, but I mean the fact that you're actually paying for it versus like
I don't,
getting it off of XM or something.
I don't do books on tape, but I do enjoy listening to the spoken word. So I wanted to ask you, do you have any distinctions within listening to the spoken word or in terms of sitting in your car? In selecting...
Including podcasts?
Well, but podcasts are a different thing. I'm now talking about that act of purchasing something that's 45 minutes or 50 minutes. Or
never.
You've never done that?
Yeah.
Okay, that's...
I mean, other than having a couple of these old comedy albums when I was a kid, I had a poster on my wall where it's just him in a white suit. It's his best fishes, and he just has a fish sitting in his suit. I probably have that poster somewhere still.
As far as I'm concerned, Tony Hancock still stands up. You do, like, any sort of... series, you have to sort of get into him and get into his persona.
Yeah.
I think if you did,
that was a tough one, like, for me to grab, like, what the heck is even going on. I assume if you were listening to it cold with more time, it would be
it's hard. You have to listen to the whole episode and like any great comedy, everything weaves through the episode to get to your big finish. Okay. And that was something that his show consistently did on a weekly basis. One album to go, I think, in the
first
one.
Yeah, should we go for it? Yeah.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. This is our special. It's two parts. Can I say this? If someone has listened for an hour and 10 minutes...
Yeah, like if you'd like to pause now, feel free to pause now and you can pick it back up.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not
missing
anything.
If you've listened for an hour and 10 minutes, you're not going to sit there and go, really, another 10 minutes? I think...
Well, if you were, you could stop. But also, a lot of people do while they're doing something else, and so they stop and go. So, all right, continue on.
All right,
so
one album to go.
My next album, we're getting off the spoken word and we're back into things, is an album called Dead Set from the Grateful Dead.
Okay.
I'm going to call this my first hippie album, and it... The obvious version would be because it's the Grateful Dead, right? But it's more than that, because it is also the first... Sorry, I'm turning away. The first album that I didn't really buy the album. I had a friend who had the album, and they recorded it onto a tape, which I'm shaking here. And you'll see I like even took the pains to make a pretty label on the edge of it here.
Hey, we've all done that.
And so it's it's got the songs. I put a little, you know, highlighter graphic on here of what the music was. And in fact, the person who made the recording for me is... Well, he owns a major league soccer team. Let's just say that.
Wow! Well, there you go. Look, that's some name dropping.
So,
yeah.
But at the time, we were young kids, and I liked that album, and I didn't want to have to buy
it. Is it a live album?
Yes. Well, so like we'll talk about the album in a second, but the other, you know, for the youth who are listening, I was thinking to myself, what do I analogize the taping of record? Because I have a whole box of tapes that are tapes of somebody else's records, or sometimes they're mine, because I used to really...
I was about to say, I used to buy albums and then make a tape.
Right, well, I used to be fastidious from the sound perspective. I wanted to have a better... quite a few albums where I made the tape so you could listen to it in a car, because obviously you can't listen to a record car. So there's quite a few like that. But then I also have some where I got the tape from somebody else, but it's sort of hippie in the sense that I can get it. But it's the analogy, of course, is Napster. And then I realized nobody's going to even know what Napster is anymore, which, of course, Napster was the thing where online you could upload your albums and you could swap albums with other people, and then really just everybody just used it to get free music. And then who put Napster out of business? Apple. With the iTunes store, where they said, you know what, if we only charge people 99 cents a song and we can do this stuff, people will opt for us even though it costs money.
I'm one of those
people. Easier, and they're not worried about the fact that they're committing crimes and stealing this music and bootlegging around, and who knows what kind of virus could get on your computer from going to these websites or downloading the wrong things. So all kind of fits into the grand realm of things. And
well, it's interesting though that this is the Grateful Dead, because the Grateful Dead are famous for not getting too hung up on people recording their shows. Am I correct? I'm not a Grateful Dead fan, but isn't it a whole subculture of, you can swap tapes of their show.
Right, well, so the other thing is, so this was, it's, I got this at the this end of high school, so it segued into the fact, so you can tape all their concerts and the live concerts, and so I also have a box full, and that's illegal, so they'll let you tape, and people are doing that with ambient microphones, so the sound is never like getting a professional album, which is what makes this album interesting, because it was my first bite at the live Grateful Dead album.
Okay.
But to me, it does not actually sound like a proper Grateful Dead concert because it's too well done. And it's one of these live albums where it's not one show. It's where they took a couple of shows, and so really they took an East Coast and West Coast show. Okay. In fact, their cover is like a picture of like the skeletons at either end of the, because one was from Radio City Music Hall, and the other part I think was from the Warfield out in California. So I have to scroll up and down here to try to find it because I have whole. By the way, we may or may not get this together, but we're hopefully going to have a Spotify playlist that will have these entire albums on there, so you can just go listen to them if you're a Spotify person.
But it would not be illegal. So do not worry. If you're like us and you still have that weird Napster hang up in you, don't worry. This will not be illegal. We're not going to put our viewers into trouble. Okay, it's interesting while you queue up here. I want to give a shout out. Just before Christmas here in the US, I saw on TV. I'll come back to that.
Yes.
Let's listen along for a moment.
I'm trying to pick out a couple songs that more people recognize. And this is Franklin's Tower, which I think anybody who sort of had a college roommate who listens to the Grateful Dead will know of this song, even if they don't like really know what it is. So now, if you have any of these regular bootleg tapes, like that you get from the concerts, or if you remember going to concerts in the 80s and 90s at the big stadiums, the sound was much muddier than this. It was like ramblier, and this is, boy, the high end in this, that does not exist on the regular tapes yet. So it sounds like it's a studio thing, but I think they just did a better job. There's another album, the Little Feet album, live album, which I'm name escaping me, was produced afterwards, and so like it doesn't totally sound like it should.
It's the reason why I don't do live albums. I don't do live music, so I'm not going to do a live album.
Well, some live albums are great, but and this is really good, very good. This is a perfect introduction to live Grateful Dead because it's much more accessible, and the songs kind of have their hooks and the like, and so it was perfect thing, and it led to me listening to a lot more of them and going to a lot of shows. But like, I got this album in 87. I think the album came out in 81, but I got this
so
recording
it's the
in
first
87.
Recording you were given, that's your first hook.
Well, no, it's my first hippie album.
First hippie album, okay,
because
sorry,
it was, but I was a bunch of different parts I was putting there because it was the first one that somebody that I officially didn't actually, I've never bought this album. I bought other Grateful Dead album, but I've never bought this album. I just have this tape. Like, and now I listen to it. I listen to it on Spotify. So I do not own a copy of this album that was pressed in a factory anywhere. Okay. CD or record or tape. But it had a full-blown like setup in the concert. Like every concert the Grateful Dead do, they do like a very long protracted drum solo and weird instrumental thing. And they had that mixed into it. Trying to think what else I planned on playing. It's also, they have a little bit of... they had a little bit of a disco thing. Not disco is not the right word. People called it Disco Dead, but it was because they had added a bit of electronic.
Okay.
And like, so if you listen to this. So they've got a keyboard player. It's like he was now, at this point, I think this was Midland. Remember, they had the keyboard player from the Tubes, and I always get things out of order as to which, because they had, like, so the Grateful Dead.
There's a name, there's a reference I didn't think I was going to hear on this show.
The Grateful Dead have had about five different keyboard players because they tend to die.
Yes, I was just about to say, people keep dying, don't they?
But most of the other people.
And turn it down, but let it, keep it like playing, because this is our last one, and the dead don't care.
there you go.
So, my unfinished thought from earlier, but just before Christmas here in the US, and it was a show that was on PBS here, and I think it was on the BBC back in England. It was an 8-part series called Soundbreaking, and it was basically the history of produced music.
Yeah.
And it's all about how the studio changed music, and in terms of how it was made, how we got it, how artists took advantage of the medium. It was George Martin, the famous Beatles, Sir George Martin, who just passed away recently, the Beatles producer, was a big part of the show. Anyway, they had a whole episode about the Grateful Dead, which seems slightly counterintuitive because the Grateful Dead, they're a live act. But what they talked about was the whole the whole attitude the Dead had to people recording and swapping singles and creating a library and their backstory that they could get behind as a band. Like, it wasn't an issue to them. I know a lot of bands, and is it Metallica, who have always been very...
Yeah, they tried. They were one of the first ones into Napster, and they're like avoiding getting put out there.
But it was interesting that there was basically nearly a whole show dedicated to the Grateful Dead and the whole notion of home taping.
Yeah.
And anyway,
so Fish is the modern Fish that does that, and Dave Matthews has classically done that. I don't know what they do nowadays, but like certainly in the earlier, Dave Matthews did it, and that's how they became popular, because college kids would like, oh, my friend got a tape of Dave Matthews playing someplace, and they would swap it around.
So anyway, I think you can find it on your on demand. It's called Soundbreakin'. If you like music, I would highly recommend it. It's great. It goes through all kinds of different genres, and it shows how music moved from the studio that was recording singles to the studio where we can make our sound different.
Yeah, and now everybody produces their own stuff. Because you can just do it on your GarageBand on your computer.
Yeah, exactly. Like so many podcasts. So anyway, great TV series, and like I say, it ties into the Dead and that whole culture of recording stuff and swapping it. And
if anybody wants, like, now the version you can do that, there's two main resources I'll recommend. Anybody wants to hear live, like jam bands, archive.org, which is all part of the Internet Archive.
Yep.
There's a whole section that's on recording it, and the bands that allow their stuff to be put up, which not like a couple of the bigger ones who allow taping don't allow it put there because it's too easy to pull it all down. You can go to that website, and you can just stream straight from there, like just thousands and thousands and thousands of live band concerts from there for free. And then if you're really getting adventurous, you can go to I think it's E-Tree, but it's basically torrents are like peer-to-peer sharing.
Okay.
It's a big thing for people who are like stealing movies, but also bands that allow bands that allow their recordings. You can go there and click, and like a bunch of these bands like Fish will have a out thing, and by 2 that morning you'll be able to download the thing straight from E-Tree and get the concert that just got played. Meanwhile, the bands, because they realize, like, they have the technology too, so like Fish puts out all of its concerts by the next day. Like, you can buy a recording of any concert that Fish does now the next day, because they're like, well, we have all this stuff set up, we'll just put it out there, and we're happy to let you record it off of the microphones that are up in the air, but we'll also just sell it to you.
All right, so my exit question before we get out of part one, part two will follow.
By the way, this holds up.
There you go. That was my exit question. Yeah, it still holds up, but obviously now you're more than happy to buy the most upgraded.
That's right. Well, but this is
technological delivery of the song. What I'm saying is, if you could transfer your cassette version to play it now, on a modern system, would you listen to that, or would you listen to this?
No, I listen to this. This is better.
Okay.
I'm gonna tape stuff. This tape still stink. I actually have some tapes where I did the recording at a concert.
All right, so this is part one of our first album, Spring Special. In part two, we have some Cure, some rap, and a few other things.
Yeah.
See, that's the first time we don't often get to...
Yep. Go. Maybe we'll mention a few other people's
stuff. And a few other people's stuff, too. So, anyway, this has been The Atlantic Voice. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric. Take care.
Just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on the Atlantic Voice podcast. Follow us on Twitter at @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at atlanticvoice.net. Email us at atlanticvoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for The Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.